you know, there was a guy on Twitter who posted something looking to partner with somebody. It was very clear from the posting that he wanted someone to work with him or for him for free. And, you know, he's one of these guys who writes a lot of stuff. And, you know, I don't know how much he is making, but I don't think he's got the money to pay people. And what it made me realize is, first, strangers don't partner with you. Strangers get paid. Acquaintances get paid. Now, if there's someone you've worked with for a long time or is a good friend, that might be a partner. But friends of friends, you know, they're going to be skeptical. They'll open the door and they'll hear what you have to say, but they're not necessarily going to jump at the chance. Oh, I can't wait to build a startup with this person or you know, join their project. Because remember, your passion projects are your passions. They're not other people's passions. And it's great when those two things align, but very rarely can you eat passion. It's not a great seasoning. Passion is something that, you know, it's like all those companies that used to try to pay writers in eyeballs. Hey, contribute to HuffPo. Sure, you might not make any money, but think of all the eyeballs. Do you know what eyeballs taste like? They taste like shit. You know, no one can eat an eyeball. It's the worst part of cannibalism, the eyeball. They just leave that. I mean, I have a good word. Not that I know any cannibals. And there is one exception. And these are young climbers. So these are people who sometimes are interns, sometimes are young and in a profession that they don't necessarily want to be in. And what they want to do is get to the next level. And the best way to do that is offer up some labor. That's all they have to give, usually. They're probably not experts at the thing that they want to do. But if they're passionate about it, that's sometimes worth more than expertise. And I've had these great situations. I've had people work for me, sometimes for free, sometimes, you know, for a stipend. I've had a lot of interns. And what I always promise them is they're going to learn a lot. And if they do a great job, I will help them get placed in whatever it is that they want to do and help them make introductions. And that's something I can offer, but, you know, it's really up to the individual. And I think it's a certain type of profile that is even going to be willing to consider that. And a guy online responded to the comment and he asked me, can a stranger become a mentor if you happen to be one of those young climbers? And my response to that was, it's very rare. People who are desirable mentors, they have a long line of people in their immediate circle who want to be mentored by them. They're highly desirable. And you know, those people are going to get first dibs, you know, the kids of their friends or their colleagues or whoever else, or people that they've worked with in the past. So, you know, and that also improves their network. So the more people that you mentor that are within that circle, the better it is to building strength in that network. Like if you're mentoring a kid of a friend. And the other part of it is you do mentor because you have something to offer and you have that itch to scratch, right? You want to feel wanted. You want to feel like all that wisdom that you've accumulated isn't going to waste. So you get fulfillment out of it. But it's just as fulfilling, probably more fulfilling, to mentor someone who is in your social or professional circle than someone who's a complete stranger. Now, there is that one way that I talked about, right? Which is the climber who volunteers to use their time, work for free, and do something for that person. But if your goal is to get that person to be a mentor, I don't think that's a good idea. And here's why. Someone who gets value from you is compromised. That's a person who has a vested interest in the choices that you make. So they would want you to make a choice that continues you doing work for them. So that's why a boss can't be a mentor, because they have a vested interest in what you choose or your performance. It has to be someone with no vested interest, who just has your best interest at heart. And that's very hard to find. Sometimes people, you know, luck out and they'll find someone who is maybe a former boss or someone who took them under their wing at some point, and then it works out. But a lot of times, it's not a good idea. That overlap is too great. The other part of it is, there's a life stage issue here. Not everyone is ready to be a mentor, because if you're still climbing yourself and you're still trying to conquer the world or build a business or grow your business or whatever it is that you do, become a great artist, it doesn't matter what category. But at that stage, you're still a taker. You're taking things from the world. You're taking labor. You're taking energy. You're taking things because you're still building. You need fuel to keep building. The only kind of person, from my experience, is a person who has reached a certain level where they're confident enough and they're not as hungry. They may still be competitive, but there has to be something where they've reached a comfortable place and they're in a position to give, because takers are not good givers. Now, I wrote more about this in an article about Russell Brand, and it's a long story, but just look up Russell Brand on Idea Factory. But this is a section that I talked about all this stuff. And if you can't find a mentor, and honestly, that's been one of my big regrets, because I've had people who mentored me at different stages, and sometimes they were assigned mentors, which, you know, take it for what it's worth. But I don't think it was a person who got me, you know, and understood what I was going for, what I wanted to accomplish. And you have to hit that right wavelength, because some people are wired in a different way and they're going to start pushing you or making suggestions that take you in a direction that they might want to go to, or that they are likelier to understand than one that is in your best interest, because they really get what you're trying to accomplish. And so unless you have all of those things, it's very hard to find that person. And if you do find one, hang on to them, because it's tough. And also, you need different mentors at different stages of your development, right? Because the person who helped you once, you know, when you were a young upstart, may not be the right person to guide you later on in life. All right, I've beaten this up enough. Let's go to the next one. You know, we've reached a plateau. You know, you look at phones and you look at a lot of the consumer technologies, web technologies. We've kind of flattened out, right? And at least to the naked eye, for the average consumer, you know, iPhone 12 is not going to be that different from 11 or 10. And the websites that we're on, the mobile apps that we use, I mean, think about when mobile apps first started. Oh my God, there were articles on every blog. Oh, have you seen this new app? Here's the top 10 apps in this category. There was tons of that stuff going on because there was excitement. People in this were in this discovery stage because something new had occurred. And that's over. It's very over. You don't see those articles anymore because now things have normalized. The big players have dominated. They've acquired all the little guys. And every once in a while, something will pop up like TikTok, you know, to give information to the Chinese. But, you know, things do pop up from time to time, but it's much more rare because, like anything else, you know, you have a Wild West moment. And then it calms down and the settlers come in and, you know, they start building, you know, big buildings and things kind of normalize. So the same thing is happening overall in technology, except innovation has actually moved deeper down into layers that we're not seeing. They're at platform and infrastructure layers. So things like AI, VR, AR, which is augmented reality, nanotechnology, biotechnology, cybernetics, life extension, food synthesis. These are all things that businesses deal with, not individuals. And that is hot. Those areas have so much going on, like self-driving cars and all that stuff. It's not visible to us yet, but there's a lot of action that's going to be platform level. And it's coming, but here's what else is coming with it. That next plateau is going to take, I think, a lot of jobs. It's going to automate a lot of things. It might create a lot of new jobs as well. So I'm not one of these pessimists who thinks that, oh my God, we're all going to be out of jobs because of technology. There's going to be new ones created. They might be different. They might be more esoteric. They might be less satisfying. There'll be a lot of things that are different. But I think a lot of uncertainty and a lot of turmoil results in these plateaus, because a plateau in innovation gives people the impression that the pie is fixed. It gives people, it turns on scarcity mode for people. And when you're in scarcity mode, which by the way, has been the mode for all of history, right? There's only so many resources. There's only so much energy. There's only so much, you know, land what do people do with land? To farm. And so there's only so much of everything. But now that we moved into a digital world, we're theoretically in a world of abundance. And that same abundance is in, you know, food. There's so much food everywhere, and it's dirt cheap, cheaper than it ever has been historically. And so what happens when you reach a plateau, the politics that we have now start to become toxic, you know, and the toxicity is well explained, because it's like, oh my God, there is no growth coming. There are no changes coming. There are no new industries coming our way that are going to employ new people. So people start behaving like there's scarcity. It's like, oh, this is mine. It's like, oh, how do I, you know, chop up all the other people's money and redistribute it? Because that's what happens. And so these things are all intertwined, the economics and the innovation pieces. And this was a random thought. Someone posted how it's very common for prisoners to work for free. So it's essentially slave labor. Now, on some level, you're like, okay, well, you're punished. You should be doing stuff, right? Something useful. I get that argument. I also get the argument where it's not fair to have people working for free and using their labor for for-profit businesses. That's not great either. So would we be more comfortable with that if they got paid at least a minimum wage, and that money went into an account for when they get out, or if they're not going to get out, they can direct it to a family member? I don't know. I think it could be an interesting compromise, because I think then you still get the work. I get it. It's kind of forced labor. You don't get to choose. It's like, you know, I'm going to be a coder, or I'm going to be a YouTuber, or I'm going to be all these awesome things. It's like, no, we need you to hit those rocks, or we need you to stamp out a bunch of like metal, you know, toys or parts. So anyway, it's just a random thought. I'd love to hear what you think. All right, let's keep going. So Nick Cave is a musician that I personally love. I know he's not everyone's cup of tea. He's sort of like a horror movie as a musician. And I don't say that in a negative way, but he has this sort of darkness around him. But there's also a lot of humor beneath the darkness. He's just an incredible live performer. I've seen the guy maybe 10, probably closer to 20 times. Anyway, but he's also a brilliant writer. So he's done talks in front of universities. He's done all kinds of writing. He's written movies. The guy is just a brilliant, brilliant thinker. And he puts out kind of a weekly Q&A. People, you know, fans ask him questions and he'll respond. And today he wrote something that, you know, something that I've been thinking, but Nick has a way with words and I think it's worth repeating. He wrote about mercy. And he said, mercy is at the heart of any functioning and tolerant society. And if mercy is our guide, that gives us flexibility to play with ideas. Just think about comedians or any kind of creative artist, anyone who's ever pushed the boundaries of anything. That person has to try out a lot of things. A lot of things don't work. You know, it's the same in startups, and it's the same in corporate, and it's the same in art. You throw a lot of stuff against the wall, and such a small percentage of it sticks. That's why corporations keep doing the same thing over and over, because they found miraculously something that's working. And it's the same thing with TV shows, like these late night shows. They go on forever because it's worked. And so if you don't give people the flexibility to throw a lot of things at the wall, and yeah, there are going to be things that are offensive, that are wrong, that are unpleasant, that are uncomfortable, but you have to let them do it. You have to forgive them if they make a mistake, and you have to recognize that that's the art. That is art. That's the definition of it. And everything else is oppression. Now, I understand if you want to chop up a bunch of dogs and use the blood to decorate your canvas, that might be a problem. But short of illegality or something incredibly cruel, you have to give people the leeway. And especially I'm a big fan of comedy, so I go to clubs. You don't know what jokes are going to work in advance. You don't know what premises are going to be offensive. You might have some notions, and sometimes you say things off the cuff. Like, I might say something now that I regret, but are you going to hold that against me forever because I'm speaking extemporaneously? Anyway, and he also said, cancel culture is mercy's antithesis. Political correctness has become the unhappiest religion in the world. And I agree with him. And I suggest you sign up for his newsletter. It's really good. Really smart guy. Okay. So a guy online asked me if I think standalone artificial intelligence is possible or probable. Because right now, artificial intelligence is kind of built into a lot of other things, right? So, the way Google maybe decides what's important to you, or Facebook decides what to show in your algorithm and what not to show. Hopefully they're showing this video. But the idea is that it's being embedded. So it's not like there's, like a AI box that you go to. But the question was, would a pure AI make sense? And I think it does make sense in virtual worlds, because I think at some point you're going to be able to generate things that feel like surfaces, things that feel like planets, beings that feel like real human beings, and you may not even be able to tell them apart. So as AI progresses, that realism level also progresses, and I think the best place for something that's pure AI to exist is inside of that virtual realm. Now, there's a game called No Man's Sky, and I'm going to do a whole special piece about this in a future episode. But it's a great example, because No Man's Sky is a game where you explore infinite universes, and it generates planets and animals on those planets and life forms on the fly based on the rules of that planet. Anyway, super interesting, and I think we're heading in that direction. Now, I don't think there's a reason to have something that's purely cognitive in nature. However, scientists might, just to see, how smart can this thing get? Now, once there is a standalone AI, that's a good indicator that we are done. We are done. And you can pick your movie and sci-fi dystopia, but standalone AI that is sentient is going to have some very, very ominous implications. This is a quick one. Iceberg lettuce is a hate crime. Someone needed to say it. I think it should be me. I don't know who enjoys this, but it is the most disgusting. It's crunchy water. And I find it offensive that it takes up, it's like the guy on the subway or the woman who takes up two seats with their bags or something. It's like, lettuce takes up space but provides nothing in return. So if you enjoy lettuce, why don't you consider, no one enjoys lettuce. If you enjoy lettuce, turn this off. I want you to turn this off. But if you are thinking about lettuce, why don't you consider some onions and some cucumbers and things that have a little bit of flavor to it? Anyway, this is a public service announcement. So if you're a lettuce farmer, I'm sorry, but your job needs to be eliminated. It's the one job elimination I actually support. Okay. So 27 of the biggest companies in New York, the biggest employers, have announced something big, something huge, something miraculous. They are going to employ 100,000 low-income, and I'm going to quote, Black, Latino, and Asian New Yorkers by 2030? Okay. A lot to say about this. First, let's go to my tweet. Let's first do the math. The math is that's about 10,000 people per year and 27 companies. So I calculated that the top 30 employers average about 50,000 workers in New York. So that's basically 370 workers per company at an average of 50,000 workers. That's 0.74% of their workforce. Not 74% of their workforce, not 7.4% of their workforce, but 0.74. So what they are committing to is a rounding error, basically. Let's go a little deeper. Not all of those people are new hires, right? So let's say a company hires about 10% new people every year. Yes, some leave, but they also hire new people. So let's say that's about 10% turnover. I don't know, some companies might have 20 or 30. It really just depends. And that would be about 7.4% of their workforce. But depending on the company, that's well within the range of the type of poor people or the kind of jobs that poor people would have filled in the first place. So it's this really, we've crafted a very odd society where people make pronouncements that make them look good. Corporations make pronouncements that make them look good, but there's no substance behind it. It's total trash. It's PR. And we reward it. The media doesn't question it. People don't question it. I know we're busy. There's so much stuff being thrown at us. But come on. You can't reward tokenism. This is tokenism. It's not even tokenism. I think this is just BS. This is just something they were going to do anyway. This is something that's naturally, statistically built in to their hiring already. And someone wrote on Twitter in response, they said, note, they also cleverly added Asians, easier to fill that quota since so many Asians are from top schools, which is true. And it's funny because depending on who you read and when you read it, Asians are conveniently either included as people of color or excluded. It depends on what the convenient message you want, right? Because when you want them fighting on your side, or when you think there are too many Asians in Stuyvesant, which is a gifted school in New York, then we need to say, oh, they're not people of color. And I've heard the woman who came up with the 1619 project make that argument. So she actually stated on Twitter that she doesn't think Asians are people of color. So, you know, take it for what it's worth. I think we've crafted a horrible society, not the whole society, but and this aspect of it, which is we're rewarding mindless rhetoric and tokenism instead of doing thoughtful, hard work. Equality is hard. You have to go deep into uncomfortable issues, into household issues, into all kinds of things. And no one wants to talk about real things. So they talk about, you know, canceling people or firing someone or some, all this nonsense, all this BS that doesn't amount to crap. No one wants to do the work. So there was an article on Vox saying how Kamala Harris, or Kamala, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, is a great choice for wooing Silicon Valley. And I'm like, what? So Silicon Valley and tech companies were her biggest campaign donors historically. And, you know, look, everyone gets campaign donations and everyone favors whatever industries that give them money. But you do not have to woo an industry because or win them over. It's pretty easy. You take their money and you give them favorable regulations and legislation in return. That's it. Or you take meetings with them so you know what their interests are. And so the idea just itself is preposterous that, oh, thank God we got her on the ticket to get Silicon Valley on board. You take their paychecks and you will have them on board if you make the right promises. And that applies to every single industry. So anyway, congratulations to Kamala Harris. Hopefully she makes a good VP or a good candidate if she doesn't win. Okay. I saw, and I follow this guy on Twitter. He is amazing, and not amazing in classic terms, but he is amazing as a sociological specimen. So John McAfee, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's the guy who started McAfee, the antivirus company. He's been long gone. He took his money and just went crazy. You know, so he lives this crazy lifestyle. He has been arrested 22 times in 12 countries for weapons possession, for like all kinds of crazy stuff. And it made me jealous, honestly. I was jealous because I've been having this thought about people who've really lived life. I mean, really lived it. And I even did a survey a while back. I didn't get a ton of responses, but you can get an indicative idea. I thought about people like Hemingway, Freddie Mercury, Paul Newman, Josephine Baker, Anthony Bourdain, Richard Branson, even criminals like Bonnie and Clyde or R. Kelly. These are people who had a certain unhinged component to their life that was not premeditated at all. And can you imagine living life without premeditation? It must be liberating. Now, it isn't liberating once they lock you up because you were having sex with minors and imprisoning them in your home. But short of that, let's talk about the legal ones. Let's talk about Freddie Mercury. The guy died at the age of 41, which I cried, by the way. I was the biggest Queen fan. But that's a guy who packed more life into his 41 years or whatever the number was, then my parents and me combined. My parents would have to live to be 9,000 years old to have lived anywhere near what Freddie Mercury packed in his 41 years. And I'm not talking about just success. I'm talking about, you know, this is a guy who would have been, you know, a wild person in any capacity, even if he wasn't a superstar. So it just, you know, and so I took the survey and I asked, are there adventures that you regret not having, whatever they may be? And the majority, 33% said, yeah, they're going to live with regrets. And we all make choices, right? We make choices to have families, to have relationships, to live in the suburbs, to take a 401k plan and to buy a house. And these things slowly start to lock us in to a particular lifestyle. And the more locked in you are, the less likely you are to be Freddie Mercury. But anyway, it's an interesting thought. And so when I see John McAfee getting arrested because he wasn't wearing a face mask, he was wearing a woman's thong as a face mask, I go, you know what? This guy's living and he's like 74 years old and he's just out there. And you got to appreciate people like that. It's just, you know, there's a certain free spirit there that a lot of people I know, including myself, don't have. I'm going to keep going. Let's talk about libertarianism. I've made this point before. Libertarianism is the garlic of politics. It's a great ingredient, but a horrible main course. because, you know, libertarianism, for those who don't know, basically means you let people be. You know, it's minimum legislation. It's basically just safety and, you know, whatever the, you know, property protection. But everything else is laissez-faire. So I don't think libertarianism is ever going to climb out of its niche status for a simple reason. The world is complicated. And in a complicated world, you need complicated solutions. And yes, you could make the argument we should simplify. And I would say, yes, we should. But if you want all of those tchotchkes from China and you want your iPhones and you want everything that the global supply chain gives you, including all the equipment I'm using right now, libertarianism has no answers for that. And, you know, but I think it's important in one aspect. I think libertarianism should be the tiebreaker when you're not sure. When you're not sure if a particular policy is going to work or not work, harm or help, I think it's really important for people to err on the side of empowering individuals. And this is one thing that I've been thinking about too. We touted the speech by JFK who said, "Don't ask what your country can do for you. Ask what can you do for your country." We're not asking anything of anybody anymore. It's all, what are you going to give me? What are you going to give me? I'm not getting my thing from the government. And I think we need to start asking people. An example is Israel has every single person, man or woman, serve in the military. Now, I'm not suggesting military is the answer or the only answer, maybe part of the answer, but it's a level of sacrifice and shared sacrifice that would bring us closer together. Because if we're working together towards a common purpose really early in life and working with people from all over the country, all walks of life, all races, or all sexualities, then all of a sudden, you don't have the prejudice. You don't have the stereotypes. You don't have these wild notions. And I'm not talking about just people on the right. I'm talking about people on the left too. I don't know why I'm pointing with opposite hands, but whatever part of the spectrum you come from, you're also going to have stereotypes built up. So you might build up, you know, minorities or black people or whoever as, oh my God, these oppressed people, I need to help them. I'm like, you can barely help yourself from the suburbs. You can barely get out of your parents' basement. You're not going to save an entire race. But what's interesting though is if we had that type of shared purpose and shared sacrifice, I don't think we would be where we are. And I think in some ways, libertarianism is good on the policy side, but it's also not good because it doesn't ask much of people. So I think we need to balance those two things. I think we need to ask something of our citizens, and that will create shared sacrifice and shared values. Okay, hold on. Okay. So this is kind of a funny one. There's a woman, Dr. Deborah So, who was on Joe Rogan's show, and she posted today that one of her posts was blocked by Twitter or flagged, and it said, "The following media includes potentially sensitive content, and then you can decide if you should view it." And I thought, wouldn't it be great if she just called her next book potentially sensitive content? So every message would actually be promoting the book. I had a similar idea a while back where if I was going to become a criminal mastermind in financial services, if I created a company that charged a bunch of credit cards fraudulently, I would call my company something like customer service refund. And most people, when they look at their statements, they don't know if it's a debit or a credit. So if you have like 50 cents going to customer service refund every month, you're not going to make a phone call. You're not going to sit for 2 hours. But if you're doing it across millions of accounts, then you're rich. You are super rich. Anyway, just a suggestion in case there are any criminal masterminds out there. Let's keep going. Oh, so this is something I talked about the other day, about the comeback of New York. It's not a foregone conclusion. All of these retail chains are closing. There was an article today about, all these big chains, clothing, electronics, whatever. They're all shutting down shop because, who can afford to pay these ridiculous rents if no one's showing up and the government is kind of locking people in? Anyway, so it's something to watch. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. Let's keep going. So, someone posted that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was sworn in 27 years ago. She's had the same job for 27 years. I started thinking, is there a job that I would want for 27 years and be happy with? And I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I would get an itch. There's at least a 26-year itch that happens where you're like, okay, I got to do something different. Like whatever it is, even if you're a Supreme Court justice, which it's pretty good gig, but late night talk show host, horse whisperer, something. I mean, wouldn't you want to try something else? And I feel you're locked in and, you're locked in a very similar way to the way people are locked in to rent control. I've thought about this a lot, and I'm sure it'll come up again in some other episode, but rent control causes you to make really bad decisions about your life. Because if you get a good deal on a New York City apartment, right, and you're paying well below market, even if the place is too small, even if you want to have a family, even if there's a job opportunity in another city, you might not take it. You might make a whole bunch of terrible decisions just to hang on to this thing that looks like a lottery win, but in a greater scheme of things is a huge loss because it traps you. It's a ball and chain. And this is one of those cases where libertarianism wins in my mind, and not just my mind. I think every economist, left or right, would tell you the same thing, that rent control is a bad idea. And in that same way, jobs for life are a bad idea because people need change. People need challenges. People need to move on from things, whether it's a relationship, a job, or just, a place. So this guy responded, he's like, what about venture capitalists? And I got to say, that was a pretty good call because venture capitalist is sort of like, socialite or philanthropist. It's like one of those people, you walk around with money. Everyone knows you have money and they're all trying to please you. You go to all these great parties, you hang out, you hold that glass in the perfect way, your champagne, you do all kinds of edibles with people to bond with them. And, and then if you like them enough, you cut a check to their company. So it's actually not a bad gig. And it's one that I think, it's pretty close to being able to do it for the rest of your life. So anyway, I wonder if you have any thoughts on what that type of job might be. All right. Okay. So 20 minutes. So I'm good. I'm almost there. I'm at slide 25 of 29. Then I'm going to do your questions at the end. Someone posted online that Apple is now worth almost $2 trillion as a company. Now you would think, who's buying phones in a pandemic? What, they sell all this expensive stuff. There's, they're basically a one item company, although they do have now digital services that are starting to grow. This is not rational. The valuations of stocks are not rational. There are some very serious reasons for why the market is climbing the way it is. I put a few of them here. There's been a debasement of the dollar. Like when you give out all this money, now the people who get it, who are individuals, are probably using it for rent or for expenses. But when rich people get it or rich companies get it, that just inflates asset prices. That makes things more expensive, in terms of stocks, in terms of, acquisitions, in terms of, bonds, all the stuff. The entire market just gets flooded with cash and people just start buying and bidding stuff up. Homes get inflated in value. Anyway, so because it takes more and more money to buy these things, the actual dollars are decreasing. And so the place where you're going to see that most is internationally because, assets compete in a global setting, right? So if one country starts printing a bunch of money and debasing it, you're going to invest in places where there's less debasement. So you might go to Europe, or you might go to, you know, South America, which I'm not sure this is a great idea either. And there's also lack of good investment options. I mean, as I said before, there's not that many great new companies that are being started. There's certainly a few, but not enough for all the cash that's floating around there. And it has to go somewhere. So a lot of it is just going to inflate these stock prices. And there's also been a lot of speculative trading. There's a bunch of douchebags sitting around at home, a lot of kids who are investing or day trading. They're not investing, they're just gambling online. And so a lot of that speculative trading is driving prices. And there's also a big bet on this virtual life that we have, because the companies that are outperforming are all digital companies. So, you know, that's why this is, you know, Apple is worth almost $2 trillion, because they're providing you tools and services that are the portal to not leaving the couch, which is what, you know, a lot of people seem to think is going to happen when not a lot of people are going into office buildings. Keep going. So yeah, I kind of made this point. So yeah, you'll see this in international trade. When you have to use our money to buy things internationally, if you debase the currency, then guess what? They're going to demand more of those dollars in order to sell you those goods. And of course, these currencies float against each other. So if they're debasing too, then we can, you know, ride that thing down together. Oh, so this was interesting. R. Kelly was accused of sending three goons to go after the accusers. And first they tried to buy them off, and then they started threatening them, allegedly. And I suspect this happens way more often. This is not just something from gangster movies. I grew up in Brooklyn, where this was the norm. Like there was a legit mafia presence, and you had to pay up. And sometimes if you threaten somebody's ability to make money by suing them, or by, you know, threatening to put them in jail, whatever it is, whatever the threat is, you don't think they're going to do something to prevent that? And the less scrupulous they are as a person, the worse that action might be. I just think it works more often than not, and we just don't hear about it. Oh, College Humor. I'm sure you've seen their videos online. They're pretty funny. They're kind of innocuous. They do pretty good videos. They're gone. They're done. Because look, Facebook and all these other platforms, they control what gets viewed and what doesn't get viewed. And these guys never took control of their distribution. And if you don't, you're basically at the mercy of these third parties. I'm at the mercy of Facebook distribution now. I'm going to start broadcasting this to other channels, but that's the reality. They get to decide whether you are paying them enough to be shown to even your own followers, or if you die in obscurity, which is what Twitter's doing to me, because my stuff doesn't get seen and I don't have anyone to contact there. I can't even take out an ad on Twitter. I put out an ad and no one responds. Customer service doesn't respond. The ad never becomes active. Don't know what happened. They never communicated with me. My stuff doesn't get seen. My followers don't grow. Can't stop it. And I did a lot on this. There's a podcast I did. It's a two-parter on the future of media. I recommend you check it out. It's really good. It's fun. And it's got a lot of all of this information, all these ideas about media. Oh, Kanye posted his cap today, 2020 vision. I don't know what Kanye's vision is. I mean, he's a visionary when it comes to music. I haven't heard any of his policy ideas. But I mean, look, how long are we going to keep pretending this is a thing? He can't even register in most states. So are we done yet? And I already voted by mail for Yanni. Was it Yanni versus Laurel? I made my choice. That's it. That's all the voting I need to do. That's it. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to do another one probably next week, maybe two, depends on how many tweets and what else is going on. I'm going to try to cut these up into some sort of highlight reel and or individual highlights and post them up as well. Hope you enjoy it. Tell a friend, share them with others, and hopefully I can beat the Twitter ban and we can together join forces and be mistweeted by Steve Factor.